Okay, it's 1 o'clock, so welcome to the second hour of Comic Book Legal Defense Fund's programming here at Comic-Con International 2014. And today we have the second part of our four-part focus on the anniversary of the 1954 Kefauver hearings and the history of the Comics Code. Tomorrow we have Tales from the Code, where Paul Levitz and others will talk about the history of how the Comics Code affected changes to content. That's going to be in this room tomorrow. And they'll be telling, you know, true dirt about how the code made the change work. And then on Sunday, we have a live art jam called You Can't Draw That, where artists including Jeremy Cox and Roman Dirge will be drawing material that would have been forbidden by the code. But this afternoon, it's our privilege to unpack the true, secret, dirty history behind what made the code happen. But before we go into that, I would just like to take a moment to acknowledge all of the great volunteers that make Comic-Con happen. When you see folks out there wearing their Comic-Con shirts, wearing their volunteer badges, they're working really hard, so we want to give them a round of applause for making Comic-Con happen. Dr. Carol Tilley has gone into the history and the archives behind the 1954 moral panic that led to the Senate subcommittee hearings on comics and juvenile delinquency. And her findings have been shocking. They have found that Wortham falsified his evidence against comics, and that was picked up across media, including the New York Times and many other influential publications, finally calling into new light this defining moment in the history of comics. And so this afternoon, we're delighted to have Carol here to unpack her research and tell us a shocking story of Dr. Wortham's war on comics. Ladies and gentlemen, Carol.
May 4th, 1954. Dear Dr. Wortham, I am an eighth grader at North Fulton High. I am 13 years old, and I read comic books. I read your article in Reader's Digest on comic books, and I disagree very heartily. My opinion probably doesn't mean anything to you, because I'm only a child. But I just had to let you know my views. In your article, you claim that comic books, horror, sex, love, crime, etc., increase delinquency. I disagree. I believe those children you spoke of were delinquent before they ever saw a comic book. I have at least 25 friends, and we all read the same kind of comics. I sincerely believe we are all of sound mind, and I very seriously doubt that comic books will injure us. I don't know if you've ever known people, adults, who drank, but I do. The alcohol, I believe, may be good in moderation, and for people who know how and how much to drink. But how about the weak adults who don't know how to drink? Why then outlaw comic books from us who can read them without first doing something about you, the adult's own bad habits, the liquor? Have you ever looked at an adult crime book? Do you really believe that our comic books do more harm than these crime, horror, and sex books written for adults? Do you also plan to put a control over adult crime books, cigarettes, and alcohol? What percent of all children reading comics go around killing people? Do you approve of smoking? Does not that injure you more than our comic books? Do you suggest that all children give up comic books, our amusement, and turn now to cigarettes, adult crime, and sex books, and liquor, adult amusement? If we did, wouldn't we have a fine U.S. in a few years? No. Until you can answer all my questions to my satisfaction, my friends and I will continue to read comic books. I want you to understand that I am not trying to be rude, but just expressing my views on this subject. I would very much like to know your opinion on it, and I will await your reply eagerly. Sincerely, Lynn Crawford, Atlanta, Georgia. So Lynn's letter was addressed to Frederick Wortham, whose book Seduction of the Innocent had just been excerpted in Reader's Digest. I probably don't need to tell any of you out there who Frederick Wortham was, because for anyone who's interested in 20th century pop culture, especially comics. Frederick Wortham and his book Seduction of the Innocent is a cultural touchstone. Moreover, it captured the American public's imagination when it was published in April 1954, 60 years ago this year. Eminent sociologist C. Wright Mills wrote in the New York Times, calling it, quote, a most commendable use of the professional mind in the service of the public, end quote. Joy Omer Morgan, who was editor of the National Education Association's NEA Journal, selected it as the book of the year, recommending it to parents, teachers, and librarians. And within a few months of its publication, it had sold more than 16,000 copies in the U.S., and in early 1955, it was released in Britain, where it also sold numerous copies. Seduction was really a stirring call for limitations on the sale of comics to children based on the author's clinical evidence, and I'm using the scare quotes intentionally, of the format's detrimental links to juvenile delinquency and general children's welfare. But more on that later. His argument, popularly remembered, is a simple one. Reading crime comic books harms children's moral, social, physical, and mental development. Now, you'll note that he limited his condemnation to crime comics. For Wortham, though, crime comics were not only the ones such as what you see up on the screen that feature crime in the title. Instead, for him, crime comics were comic books that depict crime, whether the setting was urban, western, science fiction, jungle, adventure, or the realm of Superman, horror, or supernatural beings. So whether it was a cowboy shootout, a cartoonish rabbit getting whacked on the head, a superhero, a thwarting criminal, all of these and more counted as crime motifs. And as a result, almost no sector of the comics publishing industry was immune from Wortham's critiques. Wortham viewed the violent content of comics and other mass media as a public health concern that demanded regulation. That children encountered violent content in mass media was especially insidious. He believed it harmed their ethical development. For him, it wasn't an issue of morality. It was rather an orientation as to what is right and wrong that he viewed as part of normal mental health. So, as you can imagine, San Diego Comic-Con, in his view, might be one of the most dangerous places in the world. So congratulations on braving it for today. Wortham was a respected, if more than a little temperamental, psychiatrist who was active in the U.S. from the 1920s through the early 1970s. He identified himself as a forensic psychiatrist, studying people such as the cannibalistic serial killer Albert Fish. He was born in Germany in 1895 and got a start in the U.S. in the 1920s at the Phipps Psychiatric Clinic, which was part of the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. In the 1930s, he moved to New York City and worked at Queens General Hospital and Bellevue and other places. And by the 1940s, he was devoting much of his practice to the diagnosis and treatment of children identified by schools, social welfare agencies, law enforcement, and court officers as juvenile delinquents. Some of these children were patients at the Lafar Clinic in Harlem, which is where these photos are from. He co-founded this clinic in the 1940s. Here, he and his integrated staff of volunteers treated African Americans, including many children, who were otherwise denied treatment at other medical facilities in the city. Besides a classification of delinquency or some other behavioral or mental health condition, which might be anything from bedwetting to nail biting to daydreaming, what almost all of Wortham's young patients shared and what he sought most to understand was their pastime of reading comics. That his young patients read comics was, to Wortham's mind, both causal and symptomatic of the conditions he sought to treat. This belief fueled his work and secured his popular legacy as an overzealous reformer, eager to quash comic books and their publishers in an attempt to save the young people of America from illiteracy, delinquency, mental illness, and other certain doom. So I come to you today not only as a comics fan, but as a comics scholar. And for the next 35, 40 minutes, I want to share with you some of the stories that few people know about Dr. Wertham's war on comics. And along the way, I hope to share a little bit about what it meant to be a comics reading kid in the 1940s and 50s, as well as a little bit about why Wertham and his ideas still matter 60 years later. But first, now I know a lot of you, if not most of you, know plenty about the history of comics publishing in the U.S. But just in case, let me do a quick 2 or 3 minute overview. So newspaper comic strips have been collected into book format for resale as early as 1903 and into pamphlet format for promotional purposes as early as 1929. Comic books, the kind that we might recognize today, didn't really begin to reach a wide audience until publishers introduced Superman and other original characters in the late 30s. At first, readers could find a couple of dozen different comic books on the newsstands and in drugstores, and by the mid-1940s, that number had climbed to more than 100. By 1940, just a couple of years after Superman was on the market and comics publishing was taking off, the dollar sales of comic books in the U.S. outstripped the dollar sales of children's books, conventionally published children's books, by 5 to 1. $10 million a year versus $2 million a year. Superhero titles dominated the marketplace through the end of World War II, but there were other genres too, like adventure and funny animal titles. Now, some literary and cultural critics early on objected to superhero themes because they perceived them to be violent and fascist. But because many superheroes contributed to the war effort through their storylines, and because, quite frankly, most adults were too busy worrying about World War II to be too concerned about comics, these early objections didn't really reach a critical mass. Now, superheroes, funny animal, and adventure comics continued to be published after World War II ended, but publishers also introduced new genres, such as romance and horror and true crime, and these really did flourish. In part, publishers intended that these new genres capture the reading interest of more mature readers, especially veterans and other young adults who had been weaned on superhero comics, but now wanted more substantive reading matter. Now, the fact that publishers intended these newer genres for maybe a non-child audience failed to keep younger readers from devouring comics with deliciously provocative titles such as Untamed Love, Forbidden Worlds, and Shocking Mystery. And I know if I had been alive at this point and a kid, I would have been reading those titles too. Kids loved and devoured comics. It's hard to believe now that in the 1940s and 1950s, there were more kids reading comics than are playing video games today, than text each other, than go online on Facebook. In the 1940s and 50s, more than 95% of all kids, whether they were girls, boys, rich, poor, white, black, brown, read comics regularly. And it wasn't just that kids were reading one or two comics. They might be following as many as 20 to 25 different comics titles on a regular basis and an equal number of comic strips and newspapers. So kids were saturated, their lives were saturated with comics. More than 80% of high school teens were also reading comics as voraciously. By the early 1950s, more than 600 different comics titles could be found on newsstands, and sales reached 100 million new issues every month. If you do the math, you look at the population, that was more than 30 comics sold for every person then alive in the U.S. And I think that any comics publisher today would be really excited by that. If you think about it, sales figures actually shortchanged readership because the pass-through rate, which is the number of different hands that a comic might touch after purchase, was estimated at between 5 and 8 people. So given the prevalence of comics readership among young people, it's probably unremarkable that Wortham and his associates took an interest in the phenomenon of comics reading. But what is remarkable is the fervor with which Wortham took up the clinical study of comics and how quickly he came to denounce comics reading as a malignant pastime with repercussions for individual youth as well as our social fabric. I love the photo on the top right. So if you read comics enough, apparently it leads you to stab people with ink pens, which is a horrible thing. But beginning in 1948, Wortham became the leading public figure of the American anti-comics movement. He wrote and spoke prolifically on the subject of crime comics and their contributions to juvenile delinquency and mental infirmity. You could encounter his message in venues as diverse as the magazines The Saturday Review of Literature and Ladies' Home Journal, or the meetings of the American Prison Association, or the Women's National Book Association. He was often on the radio. Government groups, including the New York Joint Legislative Committee to Study the Publication of Comics, how's that for a name, in 1951, and the U.S. Senate's Judiciary Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency in 1954, consulted Wortham as they undertook discussions related to the effects of comics reading. He was in such demand that he regularly turned down requests to speak, and he was arguably the man to turn to if you needed someone to represent the anti-comics viewpoint. So let's start in 1947. Wortham's first rant about comics, and I from all I've read about it, it really was a rant, came when he was testifying in Washington, D.C. before a post office commission, and he was there actually to defend the publisher of a nudist magazine against charges of obscenity. Now, Wortham spent 3 hours in the witness chair. By all indications, once he started talking, it was very difficult to get him to be quiet. And in his 3 hours, he argued that nudity on its own was much less reprehensible than almost anything he could find in comics. Judith Crist, who was then a writer for the New York Herald Tribune, wrote about Wortham's testimony. And this is a quote from the article. Thumbing through his pile of comic books, Dr. Wortham pointed to one illustration after another. The reader gets the impression that all women are young and pretty and have accentuated breasts at all times. In all locales, they run around barefoot in brassieres and panties. It's obvious to the simplest GI, let alone to a psychiatrist, he added parenthetically, that a half-dressed woman is far more enticing than one without clothes. Judith Crist went on, some of you may recognize her name, she went on to a long, respected career as a film critic. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, though, she was a young beat reporter, just beginning her career, and she quickly became one of Frederick Wortham's confidants and allies in the war against comics. They corresponded over a period of several years. Throughout late 1947 and 1948, Wortham began compiling massive amounts of intelligence against the comics industry. Much of his early understanding was shaped by information funneled to him by Gershon Legman, who's the gentleman on the left. Legman was a self-described folklorist and publisher who was especially interested in matters relating to two things, humor and sex. Legman fed Wortham's appetite for inside information, sending him lists of crime comics, explaining how comics changed titles but retained issue numbering, outlining suspicious business connections, and even sharing reports of New York University professor Harvey Zorba's workshop on comics. And this is Zorba on the right, and one of the announcements for the workshop. Zorba was an early advocate for comics in education, and he hosted several workshops at New York University in the late 1940s focused on how to use the comics medium to support learning. Stan Lee, the same Stan Lee, the Marvel gadabout today, was likely an attendee at least one of these workshops. Legman wrote to Wortham in December 1947 saying, quote, I wonder if you know the fake seminar being run by Harvey Zorba. presumably an examination of the comics. Of the first 17 speakers, 15 were paid agents of the comic book companies themselves. Why don't you drop in and break up the party with a few facts? So this germ of an idea that there were paid agents or apologists for the comics planted by Legman in this letter really took hold of Wortham. And Wortham began seeking even more information about people who were employed in an advisory capacity for companies like DC National, Fawcett, Hillman, and others. It really didn't take long for Wortham's work, together with the growing number of attempts to legislate the sale of comics, along with dozens of comics burnings and more, to really put the comics industry on notice. By late 1948, comics publishers felt compelled to create the Association of Comics Magazine Publishers, that's the ACMP over here, and they devised an early editorial code. The ACMP really had little authority, and some of the biggest publishers, such as DC National, didn't even join. They felt like their own in-house codes were relevant enough. But there were still really incredibly bitter feelings directed at Wortham and his colleagues. And so, for instance, in September 1948, Hilda Mossey, who was a psychiatrist who worked in Wortham's clinic, appeared with Gus Edson, who was the creator of the Gumps comic strip, and Mort Weisinger, who you may know as the editor of Superman. They appeared in a debate on a New York radio station. Now, according to an account by Mossey, who was a German immigrant, a well-regarded psychiatrist in her own right, Weisinger verbally attacked her and attacked Wortham. And she wrote, "Weisinger said he was surprised that after reading so many comic books that we had not gotten ourselves into jail and that maybe we were both out on bail now. He painted a bad picture as to what would happen if they'd make me a commissar for comic books." Over time, Wortham's ire really focused on DC National and its slate of advisors, including Loretta Bender, who's on the right, and Josette Frank on the left. Bender was a psychiatrist at Bellevue, where Wortham also worked, and there are lots of reasons that she may have held a grudge against him, and I'll have to save those for another day. But Josette Frank is really the more interesting person, for me anyway. She began working as an advisor to DC National All-American Comics in 1940, first providing feedback and guidance on the Tom Mix and Superman radio shows. And then she became part of the company's editorial advisory board for comics. She wrote book reviews that appeared in almost every issue of comics put out by DC National in the early 1940s. She reviewed scripts. She advised the comics editors on everything from advertisements to lettering in the comics. Her day job, however, was with the Child Study Association. And that was a parents' guidance organization where she served as a consultant on children's books, radios, movies and television. Her longtime boss at the Child Study Association was Sidoni Greenberg, who was for a while employed by Fawcett Comics as an editorial advisor as well. Now, Frank and the Child Study Association became Wortham's favorite target. He accused the Child Study Association of hiding its ties to comics and of being a shill for corrupt publishers. This was despite the fact that Josette Frank's name appeared in every masthead of DC Comics, and despite the fact that you can see it says consultant on Children's Reading Child Study Association of America. But somehow that was being deceptive. In the 1950s, one of Wortham's friends described going to a party in Frank's honor. Wortham was an obsessive note taker. He took notes on conversations he had with people, on phone calls, everything imaginable. And in his archives, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of little tiny pieces of paper with notes scrawled all over them, outlining conversations. And in this particular phone call that he recorded, his friend talked about going to a party given in Josette Frank's honor. And his friend described her as being, quote, insignificant, simple, and sloppy. Loretta Binder was there too, and serving tea, and according to Wortham's friend, she looked like a witch. Wortham let anyone who would listen. Nobody thought about Joseph Frank and the Child Study Association. He was always complaining about their work. So it's really not much of a surprise when Ellen Wales Walpole, that's a hard name to say very quickly, she was an erstwhile children's author who also became a confidant of Senator Estes Kefauver. And Ellen Wales Walpole contacted Wortham in early 1950. Now, Walpole had a grudge with the Child Study Association. It seems that in the late 1940s, Sidonie Grünberg had said harsh words about a series of books that Walpole was proposing on children's emotions. And I'm still uncovering pieces of this story, but it seems that Walpole funneled her anger against Grünberg's organization into a form of revenge. It was Walpole, actually, who reached out to Wortham and arranged for Wortham and Senator Kefauver to meet. Walpole continued to work with Wortham throughout 1950 and encouraged him and worked with him to develop questions that Kefauver's Committee on Organized Crime could ask comics publishers and consultants. Wortham, unfortunately, was unhappy with the results of the 1950 investigation that Kefauver led, but he still willingly testified in the 1954 Senate hearings when the issue of comics returned to that body's purview. So, as a warning, perhaps to all of you, were it not for a bad review of a children's book, it's possible that Kefauver and Wortham might never have met, and the history of comics might have been very different. Now, as Wortham became increasingly the voice of the anti-comics movement, he heard from some surprising individuals, including several comics creators. Some of them, like Malcolm Kildale and Maury Weiss, were respectable, if not big-name, comics folks. Kildale, who created probably my favorite ridiculous Golden Age superhero ever, Speed Centaur, also did some work on Classics Illustrated and a strip called Sergeant Spook. Weiss worked for Timely Comics, creating the popular teenage character Margie. Now, Kildale, I don't have a photo of him, wrote to Wortham in 1950, and he complained that the ACMP's editorial code was, quote, a farce, because the industry was being allowed to regulate itself. Kildale said, quote, I dislike censorship as much as anybody, but I believe the comic book field needs a policing, similar perhaps to the baseball world. Comics needs a Landis. And Landis, for those of you who are old enough or interested in baseball, was the first commissioner for Major League Baseball. Weiss, who spoke to Wortham in the late 1940s, told the psychiatrist that comic book publishers wanted, quote, blood, and that he agreed that crime comics were bad. That's Weiss in the bottom left. Han Fisher, the creator of Joe Palooka and one of Maury Weiss's friends, tried to draw Wortham into his long-running battle with Al Capp. Fisher shared with Wortham some of Capp's supposedly pornographic images from Little Abner, and that's Ham Fisher on the bottom right. He also told Wortham that he would be unwelcome in the halls of the National Cartoonist Society, which I find funny because I'm pretty sure that there were no actual offices, let alone halls, for the National Cartoonist Society. Most important, though, among the handful of comics creators who reached out to Frederick Wortham is Jerry Siegel, Superman's co-creator. During the early 1950s, Siegel sent form letters to a lot of folks, including, as Brad Rieke recently documented in the book Superboys, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI. But he also sent two letters to Wortham. Now, Wortham wanted to reproduce portions of Siegel's letters in Seduction of the Innocent, but the attorneys for his publisher, Reinhardt, intervened. They were really worried about getting sued. One of Wortham's confidants, another one of these meticulously documented conversations, shared with him the regular phone calls that she was getting from Siegel in late 1951. Siegel had gone on a hunger strike at that period to protest the money that DC National was earning from its new Superman television show. Wortham's confidant was really unmoved by Siegel's plight, and she reportedly told Siegel to stop it and get a job. Seduction does have a bit about Siegel and some of what Kildale, Fisher, and Weiss shared with Wortham, but it's almost all unattributed. So it's April 1954. Seduction of the Innocent was released, and Wortham testified at the Senate hearings. These were led by Senator Robert Hendrickson, although they're still commonly referred to as the Kefauver hearings, about the relationship between comics and juvenile delinquency. Wortham joined more than a dozen other witnesses, including Helen Meyer, who was vice president of Dell Publications, Walt Kelly, the creator of Pogo, who was president of the National Cartoonist Society at the time, and Bill Gaines, publisher of EC Comics. Wortham was there to represent what the Senate felt was the extreme conservative position among psychiatrists. Gaines was there as the only comics publisher besides Helen Mayer of the generally squeaky clean Dell. Now, I included this photo on the right. This is from 1956. And this is Estes Kefauver and his family. You'll notice that his kids are reading comic books. I love this image. And even though this is from 1956, and I know that it was taken that year from the best of my investigative abilities, I'm amused because the comics that they're reading are Dell comics from pre-code, the pre-code period. Now, in the popular imagination, this is Bill Gaines on the bottom. Bill Gaines was the whipping boy for the public's outrage against violence in comics. In a few short years, Gaines had transformed a struggling company that he inherited from his father into a stable publisher of provocative, mature, and sometimes gruesome comics. Comics like crime suspense stories and weird fantasy had an avid readership among those folks who were looking for something more than men in tights. Both Wortham and Bill Gaines' testimony at these hearings are well-remembered among comics nerds and geeks like us. But what's less well-remembered is that through a series of editorials published about the same time as the Senate hearings, Gaines invited EC's readers to share their views on comics with the Senate subcommittee. About 200 readers, most of them kids, wrote to the Senate subcommittee. Here's part of one letter from an EC fan that went to the Senate. "Dear sirs, I am disgusted with your ridiculous claims about comics. I assure you that I am not and do not want to be a juvenile delinquent. We don't buy these mags because we have a thirst for blood. We buy them for the stories, the snap endings, the artwork, and because they deal with the unknown." That letter was written by 14-year-old Phil Proctor. His disappointment in what public outcry, the Senate hearings, and eventually the Comics Code did to his beloved comics helped propel him to a career as a satirist. He co-founded the Firesign Theater, and if you don't know the Firesign Theater, it's vaguely like America's Monty Python. That's the closest comparison I can give. Proctor told me recently that he decided to devote his life to ridiculing, quote, the blue-nosed, tight-assed censors, like the ones who crippled the comics industry. The Senate didn't respond to all of the letter writers. A few of them got postcards, but Proctor and most other folks never heard anything. The Senate subcommittee also never acted on comics, except to issue a report of the hearings. However, the writing was on the wall. And so, bowing to public and governmental pressure, comics publishers created the Comics Magazine Association of America, the CMAA, in the fall of 1954. And that body implemented quite quickly a restrictive editorial code, the Comics Code. Now, aimed at staving off government intervention in the industry, the CMAA's code crippled the successful comics industry by ensuring that comics which carried its imprimatur were free of everything offensive, that you could imagine. Poor grammar, excessive violence, disobedient children, and supernatural beings like vampires and zombies and werewolves. Poor Robert Kirkman wouldn't have had a chance in those days. The code persisted with modifications until January 2011. The CMAA's code seemed to placate many people who were concerned about comics, although Wortham really was skeptical of the whole endeavor. And he wasn't alone. Lyle Stewart, the gentleman on the left, was publisher of the Scandal Sheet expose and a general gadabout around the EC Comics offices. He approached Wortham on behalf of Bill Gaines about becoming the czar of the comics code. Now, exactly what he proposed is probably lost to history. Gaines lost any influence he had in forming the Comics Code Authority, and the power players chose Charles Murphy, this gentleman on the right, to serve as the code's first administrator. In November of 1954, Lyle Stewart sent Wortham a comic that bore the new Comics Code seal, and it included a letter which says, in part, "Here is promised is a cover with the Code Authority seal. I would appreciate it if its source were not revealed in your use of it. Judge Murphy, as you may be aware, is a not very bright political hack who was selected mostly because of his religious faith. Not too surprisingly, his code reads like a Catholic Church code approved by Cardinal Spellman. Bill Gaines, who for all his faults has played it straight and in good faith at all times, now will be the victim of his own honesty." So at the time Stewart wrote this letter, Gaines had already shut down production of all of his comic titles except for Mad, which he switched to a magazine format because he found very quickly that the Comics Code was stacked against him. The Comics Code Authority eviscerated comics contents, decimated the industry, and began the long, painful decline in young people's readership. The code led the way to fewer comics publishers, fewer comics titles, and fewer comics readers, especially fewer kids reading comics. Of course, it also arguably helped pave the way for the underground comics movement of the 1960s and 70s that in turn helped spark the more contemporary alternative and indie press comics movement. And that is me trying desperately to look for a silver lining. The eminent cartoonist Carl Barks, of Donald Duck fame, had a slightly different take on what the code and Wortham had to do. Writing to a fan in the late 1970s, Barks said, quote, "Although much glory was heaped upon the quality of the Gaines output, I am inclined to believe that the infamous book by Dr. Wortham was all that saved comic books from total destruction at the hands of the tasteless publishers of senseless gore. I know that many people argue that what children and grown-ups read does not influence their behavior. I wonder if those people ever heard of a book called the Bible or another called the Quran." Wortham died in 1981, and his papers soon afterwards made their way to the Library of Congress, where, until 2010, they were unavailable to the public because of his executor's wishes. As some of you know, I've spent a few weeks at the Library of Congress now examining a portion of this extensive collection. There are 200 boxes of papers. And what I found, and what I've written about in a scholarly, kind of boring paper, is the fact that Wortham made up and misconstrued some of his evidence against comics. Now, plenty of people had long questioned his sensationalized rhetoric, his logical inconsistencies, and lack of documentation. But I discovered that he asked kids leading questions. He altered their words or knitted together their quotes in misleading ways. In part, he omitted relevant details about his young patients' lives that might help us to understand what their circumstances were. And those are just some of the most egregious offenses. And I want to share with you a couple of examples. Now, in Seduction of the Innocent, Wortham introduces us to a young girl, a young patient named Vivian. And I'm going to read to you the full excerpt, everything he has to say about Vivian. "A nice, friendly girl of 12 was brought to me by her mother because she had stolen some money from a lodger. She has a mind of her own, the mother said to me.
Oops. Sorry about that. Time for a backup. All right.
She has a mind of her own, the mother said to me. It goes and comes. The teacher complains that she can't get any work out of her at times. Careful study of the girl over a period of time showed little that was wrong. The social worker asked the mother how the girl spent her time after school. Reading love comics, the mother replied. I have nothing against comic books, but she reads them all the time. This girl I found to be an expert on love comics. She told me she bought some, but mostly I trade them. I asked her about stealing in comics. She laughed. Oh, they do it often. A boy stole a bracelet from a girl he loves very much. He got caught, but still loved him. He spent a term in jail. When he got out, he did it again and got sent up to jail again. The girl went to jail to see him, but she fell in love with another boy and got married. That's kind of sweet. This girl was full of such plots. It was hard to determine whether she daydreamed more of loving or of stealing. Now, the actual records I found in Wortham's papers tell a slightly different story. If I can make this cooperate. Vivian visited one of Wortham's practices at least twice, perhaps only twice, in the winter of 1951. Wortham may not have been the person who examined her. She was 13, not 12, as Wortham stated in Seduction. She was African-American, and her teacher made a referral. Her most recent report card was excellent, according to her mother, and Vivian played the piano beautifully. The girl may have stolen a dollar or so from the lodgers living in her family's home. She may also have stolen a ring from her piano teacher. Vivian's mother reported that the girl was a liar. In the report's two pages, that's all there was, we learned that Vivian's mother slapped her hard in the face, that her mother was actually her stepmother, and that she had revoked Vivian's allowance. Now, to me, the section of the report that stands out most is this, quote, mother says they want to put her in an institution. There was nothing about Vivian daydreaming, either about love or stealing. She did relate the story from a comic about a man going to jail for stealing a bracelet. It was the only story from comics she seemed to have discussed. She told Wortham that sometimes, but not often, people steal in love comics. At the time that she was seen by Wortham and his associates, Vivian wasn't even an avid comics reader. She had been in the past. She said she read them if she had them, buying them only occasionally. In fact, her mother confirmed that Vivian was more enthralled by television than comics at that point. Wortham is often popularly remembered for messing with my slides. As a source for the idea that Batman and Robin are actually lovers, but a wish dream of two homosexuals living together. Incidentally, he viewed it more as a pederastic relationship than one between equals, but that's still another story for another day. One of his sources of insight was purportedly a young homosexual who arrived for therapy with a copy of Detective Comics, one of the titles that carried Batman and Robin stories. This young man showed Wortham and his associates an image from the story that depicted the pair's domestic bliss and recounted his sexual awakening inspired by comics. Quote, I think I put myself in the position of Robin. I did want to have relations with Batman, he said. Now, in a move of authorial creativity, Wortham actually invented this young man from two separate individuals, aged 16 and 17, who had been in a mutual sexual relationship for several years. Wortham combined their statements. It was the 17-year-old who noted, quote, the only suggestion of homosexuality may be that they seem to be so close to each other. One of the boys told Wortham that he hadn't looked at Batman or Superman in a long time, but had picked up a copy recently and found, quote, no homosexual suggestion in it, end quote.
Wortham also failed to mention that the two teens had found the Submariner and Tarzan, neither of whom had male sidekicks, along with bodybuilding magazines, to be better subjects for their homoerotic fantasies as early teens. Now, the more egregious example of Wortham unnecessarily homoeroticizing Batman is the case of John, about whom he wrote the following. A boy of 13 was treated by me in the clinic while he was on several years probation. He and a companion had forced a boy of 8, threatening him with a knife, to undress and carry out sexual practices with them. Like many other homoerotically inclined children, he was a special devotee of Batman. Quote, sometimes I read them over and over again. They show off a lot. I don't remember Batman's name, but the boy's name is Robin. They live together. It could be that Batman did something with Robin, like I did with the younger boy. Batman could have saved this boy's life. Robin looks something like a girl. He only has trunks on. Now, I want you to compare this with what was actually spoken by the boy. Now, this is a little tricky to read, so if you take a look, the text that's in blue appeared in the case notes. The text that's in, but not in the final version of Seduction of the Innocent. The text that's in red appeared in Seduction of the Innocent, but the boy never said it. And the places that have been struck through, the words that have been struck through, just were omitted. John had read Batman, but perhaps only a half dozen stories. He actually told Wortham that Batman was no longer a favorite comic for him. In that same interview, he alludes to reading comics over again only if he has nothing else to do. It's not the obsessive reading that Wortham attributed to him. Wortham also neglected to tell readers that John had been forcibly sodomized first by his companion. Now, despite the distance of 60 years and documentary evidence of his wrongheadedness, we're still living with Wortham's legacy, the results of his war on comics. The comics code is dead, yes. Libraries collect comics, and they're taught in schools, and we give parties for comics like this one. But there is still this undercurrent that comics are something less than, that comics are dangerous. Part of my work is to help us recover and remember these stories about comic censorship and about young readers. And I want to point out that the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund is a big part of that work in helping keep us safe. Now, I want to close with a portion of one final letter. Most of the young people who wrote to Wortham read only the excerpt from his book that appeared in Reader's Digest. One teen, though, actually read Seduction of the Innocent in its entirety. He was able to do so because he asked the librarian in his small-town Texas community to order a copy for him, which she did. That teen was Bob Stewart, and I hope that his name is familiar to at least some of you. Bob passed away at the end of February, and although I never met him in person, that's him up there at age 15 or 16, I did have a chance to speak with him frequently on the phone the last couple of years he was alive. So here's a portion of Bob's letter to Wortham. He was 16 when he wrote it. He was busy publishing the EC Fan Bulletin and other early comics fanzines. Route 4, Kirbyville, Texas, June 5th, 1954. Dear Dr. Wortham, I finished Seduction of the Innocent yesterday, and there are a few points that I would like to dispute with you. The first is your claim that comic books have never had critics as all other modern-day literature and art forms have. I'm sending you a copy of Petresby, which I edit and distribute to the fans of the Entertaining Comics group. Besides Petresby, there are about three or four other amateur magazines published for the purpose of providing EC comics with constant criticism. Then, too, these same fans of EC have established an interlaced correspondence system over the United States. You must admit that teenagers who have banded together to cuss and discuss the literate quality of comic books are more than juvenile delinquents. Your claim that Batman is a homosexual is the most absurd thing in the entire book. The only person who would notice anything like that would be someone deliberately looking for pornography. I would think that environment plays a larger part than you have credited to it. All kids read comics, but only some are delinquents. Comic book artists don't aspire to draw for comics. Doc, there's nothing more that I want than to draw for EC. The fact that you are against censorship is enough to make James rejoice. Because once comics are outlawed, out of existence, it'll only be a short step to the book burnings Bradbury science fictionalizes in Fahrenheit 451. Gotta go now. Quite a few things on my hands, but a little soap and water will take it off. Sin? Question mark. Shirley? Exclamation mark. Bob. Spa fond, Bob. And thank you, everyone.